Are you troubled by strange hockey trades in the middle of the night?
Do you experience feelings of dread about NHL free agency?
Have you or your family ever seen a New York Islanders game?
If the answer is yes, then don't wait another minute. Pick up your mobile device and subscribe to Lighthouse Hockey Podcast from SB Nation today.
Our courteous and efficient hosts are ready to serve all of your Islander needs and worries.
Lighthouse Hockey Podcasts for New York Islanders fans.
Batter up.
Welcome back to A Pod of Their Own. This is episode 47 of A Pod of Their Own. I am Allison McCaig, and I am joined this week by my lovely co-host, Linda Surovich. Hi, Linda.
Hey, Allison.
And Maggie Wiggin. Hi, Maggie.
Hi, Allison.
We are also joined this week by very special guest, Mark Simon. Hi, Mark.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Mark is of Sports Info Solutions, the company that sells analytics to Major League Baseball teams, so that's very exciting, and he is formerly of ESPN, where he was main researcher for Baseball Tonight. So, Mark, why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about the work that you do at Sports Info Solutions?
Sure. The easiest way for us to explain it, usually to a new audience, is if you've seen the movie Moneyball, we're the people that were providing the data to Billy Beane and the Jonah Hill character, which was Paul DePodesta, to help them in decision-making to get players like Scott Hatterberg, or for in-game strategic decision-making, like where do I put my shortstop for this particular play. We were founded in like 2002, 2003. The owner of our company owns Stats, Inc. He sold it to Fox and then started another company that decided to follow baseball in very minute detail. We track a lot of things, some of which the public sees, some of which the public doesn't. My role there is to kind of be the public face for the baseball content that we do. That means that I write for The Athletic. I blog on our company's blog. I host a podcast that we have, a baseball podcast that is devoted to defensive excellence and analytics, two topics that we felt like we could have a nice podcasting niche in. I also, and we can get into this a little bit, we provide notes similar to the way that like Stats Inc. or the Elias Sports Bureau would provide notes to an ESPN or some of the broadcast networks. We provide notes to a couple of different team broadcasts. And I can tell you we've helped educate Gary, Keith, and Ron about a variety of topics on which you might think that they might be a little resistant, but they've been pretty welcoming of our information. So that's what I do for Sports Info Solutions. We're a fairly small business. We're in eastern Pennsylvania, and right now we're just riding out the wave like everybody else.
Yeah, I can imagine. You guys are probably like most well known, at least like to me, like average baseball fan and consumer, as you know, the defensive run saved folks, the folks that came up with defensive run saved. And I know that you guys have the podcast where you talk about various defensive statistics. And I think that the general feeling among the baseball community is that defensive stats have historically kind of like lagged behind hitting stats as far as like their ability to actually measure defense accurately, and people are always debating about what the best way to measure defense is, because it's a really hairy thing to actually measure compared to, you know, hitting, which seems a little bit more straightforward. So can you talk about the challenges involved in that and how it differs from, you know, hitting statistics and things like that?
Sure. So for many years, the primary statistic that was available to fans for defense was fielding percentage, which is essentially looking at putouts, assists, and errors. But the weakness of fielding percentage is that it omits all of the plays that a fielder didn't get to, like the grounder that was in the hole between short and third, the grounder up the middle, to talk about the other New York baseball team for a second, the pasta diving Jeter kind of ground ball.
Pasta diving.
Right, exactly. So what we've done is we've devised systems and processes by which you can make those sorts of evaluations. And One way that we explain it is imagine the field as a grid, and each the field is kind of divided up into a series of squares. And within each square, if you were to tell me how hard the ball was hit, and whether it was a ground ball, a fly ball, or a line drive, and where the fielder was originally, at least within the infield, we can tell you like the out probability. It's similar to kind of like what StatCast can do. But we have different inputs than they would. So from that, you can combine that with other things that are position specific, like is a first baseman good at converting outs when he fields a bunt? Is a catcher good at framing pitches? Is a catcher good at throwing out base stealers? Is a catcher good at blocking pitches? And that's a simple, something like that. That was never tracked, but that's a fairly simple yes, no. The ball's in the dirt. The catcher either blocked it or he didn't, and the runner advanced. So we can tell you that, like, this catcher blocks pitches at a 96% rate, which is the best in the majors, and then the guys that struggle are going to be below 90%. So we have position-specific things. For outfielders, it would be things like throwing arms. We have other things, too, and this is always a neat system to introduce to people. We watch games, and we chart what we call good fielding plays and defensive misplays. And you would think of it for a good fielding play as the kind of play that you would put an asterisk on your scorecard if you're still one of those people that keep score, like, I don't anymore, but a lot of people certainly like to keep score, and they mark good plays with an asterisk.
Like, so that Gary,
I keep score whenever I don't have a child with me, as much as I want to, but like the majority of the time.
So how do you indicate the really good play?
It sort of depends on the play. Sometimes if I'm really excited, I will generally like circle the square really intensely, but that's almost always for like a big home run or something. For a sparkling play, I'm not as on that as I should.
All right. So we call those plays GFPs. But we also will credit the fielder for, and there's a little bit of judgment here, but we have a pretty strict set of rules. Think about the ball that's hit in the gap in left center, or the ball that's hit down the line that the fielder gets too quickly. And as a result, the hitter only gets a single instead of getting a double. So we give credit for that. And there's kind of like a run value that gets assigned to that. So we have 30 categories of good, and then we have 60 categories of bad. And
that twice could be as something many bad. Like,
boy, that's a, yep. Is it all, doesn't it?
That could be something like slipping and falling. that could be something as simple as throwing to the wrong base. That could be, you know, that if you keep score and you track like earned runs and unearned runs, you don't penalize the team for failure to get a double play. Like you have the grounder to short and the flip goes to second, and then the second baseman bobbles it and the guy winds up being safe at first. In your scorebook, that's still a 6-4 with no error. In our books, that's a 6-4, but with a defensive misplay by the second baseman. And he loses run value for that. So then you take everything that we talked about. Does the guy field balls and turn them into outs? And does he do all the other things that are important at his position? And you kind of smush them all together. And in the end, you get a run total. And that run total is judged against an average. So 0 is an average player. 10 is good, 20 is very good, 30 is superstar, negative 20 is worst in the league, negative 10 is bad. A lot of guys call it kind of fall into that negative 5 to 5 area where you're basically thinking of them as average fielders.
Oh, do
I have
the
to
Mets,
ask.
Yeah, I was going to say, are the Mets in their own bad category? Like, you have a specific section just for them?
I was going to ask if one of the 60 bad categories is specifically called Daniel Murphy and made it its own category.
I was literally about to ask if Daniel Murphy was his greatest dream or his worst nightmare as a statistician.
All right, so... when I was at ESPN, and we've continued it, and I'm embarrassed to acknowledge this, but I will. We have a defensive run save fantasy league.
That's amazing.
Nerds. Okay,
so you're only drafting 10. You're not drafting 25. So you're drafting one in each position, and then we have what we call the wild card. And for the wild card, you get the opposite of his value, which makes Daniel Murphy, Nick Castellanos, JD Martinez, very valuable defenders, and they tend to go very early because they have very poor defensive run save totals. So if Murphy's negative 12, you're getting 12 runs saved from him.
I love it.
Amazing.
That's amazing.
Oh, Murph. Never change.
But in answer to what you're asking about, yeah, the Mets have a lot of bad to them. they're bad at catcher. They're bad at second. They're bad at short. They're bad at J.D. Davis. They're bad at catcher. They're bad,
Linda's
like
man.
Noah Syndergaard rates poorly because of all the stolen bases that he allows. Ramos doesn't pitch frame well. Alonso is below average, but I think it's fair to say that we could see that changing over time because there were a lot of good signs from him. Rosario does not rate well. McNeil does rate well and has been useful to them because he can play multiple positions and not hurt them anywhere. J.D. Davis rates poorly. Lagares in his prime was like the top or top like a top two center fielder. So there was a time when things were good. That time is not now.
How unplayable at center is Brandon Nimmo really?
With Nimmo and Conforto, like they don't look like you wouldn't like outright say, I think that they look terrible. They're below average. And the range on that is slightly to modestly, I guess. The center field is tough because when you're in center field, you're competing against all the other center fielders. And that means that you're going up in terms of plays made against a guy like Kiermaier in Tampa Bay or a guy like Byron Buxton in Minnesota. Or like every center fielder has some skills. And everyone thinks that their center fielder is either the very best center fielder in baseball or the very worst center fielder in baseball. In truth, there are only a couple of guys that can be at the very top of the heap. But Nimmo, I would put Nimmo in the bottom, like maybe at the top of the bottom third.
Okay.
That seems right. Fair. So is Marisnyk really an upgrade over that? Because
yes.
That's okay.
Yes. That's okay. That's why they got him.
I hope he would be.
I would think that he'll play the seventh, eighth, and ninth. In any game that they're up, I don't know, two or three late, and they feel like they can make that move, that it makes sense for him to play kind of a defensive closer kind of role.
Like Lagares used to be.
Yeah, exactly, that kind of thing.
So is there a specific profile of player where you find that the eye test and DRS disagree the most often?
A specific profile? That's hard. I think so. I'm gonna kind of stall with this. I think that the eye test and the statistical test match up a lot better now than they did a few years ago, and we made some recent changes to our stats to I think make them look better. There's an interesting, I guess, quibble on someone like Hosmer. And you'll hear Keith Hernandez frequently will say, Eric Hosmer is the best first baseman in baseball. The numbers don't bear that out. I think the profile would be, there are certain guys that look the part. Like they make the very nice play or they scoop throws decently. This is, I guess, specific to first baseman. Eric Hosmer very much looks the part, kind of that long, tall first baseman who looks like he's covering a lot of ground. He's not, and that's the issue. That there were a lot of balls, I think it was the issue for him was that there were a lot of balls that slipped by him in the first base, second base hole. And that was dragging down his rating.
Okay,
and it's funny.
Dropped pop-up went against him because that made my heart so happy as a Mets fan.
That's a fascinating play because if you've like who, first of all, there are a bunch of players that I think would lose value on that play because you could make the case that any number of guys probably have historically a 100% chance of recording out there. Right. Mm-hmm. Like that's a pop-up that's right there for him. So yeah, I would think that yes, he would lose a very significant amount for the drop pop-up. just as I'm sorry, I'm going to bring this up.
No,
but just as Luis Castillo would lose a lot for the drop pop up.
That does hurt. Sorry, that cuts deep.
I would have started drinking earlier if I'd been ready for that.
We had known that we were going to get a Luis Castillo dropped pop up mention on the pod.
Well, it's my fault. I bought a Cosmer because I wanted to get a little bit of that back.
That is one of the few games I've been watching since 1982. That is one of the few games in Met history that made me turn off my TV and refuse to watch the next game outright. I went to a play. I went to see, I think, our local community theater was doing The Odd Couple. So I said, I will suffer through that rather than watch another game.
My dad has had a handful of games like that throughout Mets history, and whenever a game like that happens, the next day, like, I, a sucker, will be watching the Mets, and my dad will come in the room and go, "Your Mets are terrible, Allison," and walk away like, "Aww. Your Mets," as if I am not afflicted with this disease because of him. This is your fault, sir.
My friends, I learned it from you, Dad.
I learned it from watching you.
They're always my Mets whenever something bad happens, which is most of the time.
Well, my friend's dad was watching that game with, I think, his brothers. And they were all Yankee fans, so of course he hits the pop-up. So he starts celebrating, goes, "Yeah, in your face, we win!" And
oh,
then, of
no.
course, the ball drops. And he goes, "I just turned around and walked out." He was like, "What can I say?" He said nothing, didn't say goodbye, just turned around and walked out of the house.
Oh, man. Rough. So, Mark, speaking of our Mets-specific audience, there are a couple of projects that you've worked on that will be of interest to our audience, specifically Mets Walk-Offs, which was a blog you wrote that you are now bringing back for during COVID. So tell us a little bit about that.
So in 2005, there was a blog that existed called Plunk Biggio, which was devoted to tracking Craig Biggio's hit by pitches as he chased for the all-time record. And they would do, like, who are the all-time hit by pitch leaders by astrological sign.
Amazing.
The aughts were a wild time, kids. The aughts were wild.
Especially on the internet.
Yeah,
exactly. It was a very Wild West-ish kind of thing where, like, anything went. And I remember saying to myself, I love to chart things. So what could I actually sit and chart and, like, do something cool for? And I got the idea, like, what's my favorite kind of Met game? And my favorite kind of Met game is when they get a walk-off win. So I was like, all right, why don't I see if I could find every walk-off win in Mets history. And this is before the Baseball Reference Play Index was really sophisticated. So that meant going through a retro sheet and looking up for every home game that they won by 4 runs or less, whether they scored to win in the bottom of the ninth. So that after a couple of weeks of doing that, going through, I don't know, a couple of thousand games, whatever, I had a very nice spreadsheet with a good amount of detail. And I started writing about the different games. And they would usually be tied to, like, if something happened in baseball that night. And I caught a break in that, like, 3 or 4 days after I started. If you remember the Cliff Floyd game in 2005, that happened. Cliff Floyd hit a dramatic... Yeah, Cliff Floyd hit a dramatic walk-off home run against Brendan Donnelly of the Angels after Marlon Anderson hit a game-tying home run in the ninth inning off K-Rod.
Yes.
Okay, now that the light bulb went off.
One of my all-time favorite, just like Met kind of things. And I wrote about that game, and then I found other games that were somewhat resemblant in random ways. There was an anniversary of a famous game, which is known to Met fans that are in their like 50s as the Steve Henderson game. And as a journalist, I reached out and got Steve Henderson on the phone, and he's telling me all these details about how he gave his wife an engagement ring that day, and then they're down 6-0, and they come back and win, and it's 6-2 in the bottom of the ninth, and they score 5, and he hits his first home run of the year. And suddenly I've got, like, a series of pretty good stories. So I did that for, like, 5 years, and then ESPN started ESPN New York, and I kind of was, I guess, maybe not supposed to be doing what I was doing. So I was like, all right, if they'll let me write for ESPN New York and write Met stories, then I'll stop and we'll just I'll put the blog on pause. So I put the blog on pause for, I guess, 10 years. One of the projects that I did, though, was I tried to rank the 60 best home runs in Mets history. And that's what I decided to bring back. And I decided to expand it to 100, using 80 for the regular season and 20 for the postseason to round it out. And I've been writing about them at MetsWalkoffsAndTrivia.com.
Very exciting. I'm looking through your list right now, and I'm, like, getting fuzzy memories of some of them, the ones that I remember, the ones that I was alive for, of course.
Yep. And since I'm biased, where would have the Grand Slam single been on the list if it was an actual Grand Slam?
Oh, boy. So, okay, so I was at that game, and I always say, as soon as that game is mentioned, I always say that game will never be topped.
No.
That is the most, like, I'm not typically someone who is amped when they attend a game. But I was like kind of amped at a scary level for that one. so I put for postseason, you have to consider that they've won the World Series twice. So I think that you got to put those ahead. But yeah. Then you've got like that next year, which is like the Len Dykstra home run in 86, the Todd Pratt home run in 99, the Agbayani home run in 2000. So it's probably in that like 4 to 6 range of postseason home runs. I've got the game-winning home run in Game 7 of the 1986 World Series first. Then I've got the big home runs that they hit in Game 5 in 69. Don Clendenin and Al Weiss, those are essentially tied for second. But I think it would be the next one after that, because that was admittedly extraordinarily epic.
Yeah, if it wasn't I think there's only been one like walk-off Grand Slam in postseason history. Like, excuse you, there's two. Mets fans know the truth. I think it was the Rangers. I can't remember who it was.
Nelson Cruz.
Yes, that's who it was. Yeah. Yep, so that's the only official Grand Slam, walk-off Grand Slam right. In postseason history. But right. We know the truth.
So if you go back to when I did it to now, like trying to add on was the challenge of it. And in thinking about like, what are the meaningful home runs of essentially the 10-year hiatus for me. And I think the clear cut favorites on that are Wilmer, right?
Yeah.
And then Estrubel Cabrera against the Phillies, which is my other, this will never be topped kind of thing. I covered that game.
I was at that game actually with Chris McShane, who is the editor at Amazing Avenue. And I was like maybe 2 months pregnant with my daughter. And like, I don't think anyone here is pregnant. I will, at 2 months, you're just exhausted all the time. Like I would be going to bed at like 8 o'clock at night, but I wanted to go to this game. And then it goes into extras. And the only catch was that I knew that Chris would give me a ride home if I stayed. Otherwise, I'd be on the train. And so I stuck it out. I thought I was just going to like pass out until that last inning. And it was just like the greatest inning ever. And I would stay for that game 1,000 times out of 1,000. So, yes, I agree. That is way up there.
So both of those are in my top 15. And in fact, I got Wilmer. I was like with Wilmer, I felt like I had to get it in my top 10. And it was just a matter of trying to squeeze it in. And I mentioned the Steve Henderson game before. That one is 10th. Wilmer is 9th. And I feel like those are like identifying games for certain generations. Like if you ask someone like, if you follow Faith and Fear and you talk to someone like Greg Prince, the Steve Henderson game is like a touchstone game for him, June 14th, 1980. And I feel like that for people that are probably in their 20s and 30s, that the Wilmer Flores Tears of Joy game is like right there with that. So that's why it's 9th on my list. Estrubel Cabrera is just a little bit behind that. There were Willie Mays jumps Estrubel Cabrera, among other things. Willie Mays homering in his first game as a Met, which was like another kind of epic kind of moment, is ahead of it.
Fans of this podcast know I have mentioned this a few times on the pod, I think, but the one that sticks out to me here like a sore freaking thumb, number 18, August 22nd, 2006, should have been at that game, but my brother was there instead because it was his birthday. Forever mad. Should have been at that game. My dad was at that game. My brother was at that game. I was not. But that's...
So, That's the Carlos Beltran home run against the Cardinals, the game where Pujols had the 7 RBIs, Delgado hit his, I guess, 400th, and then Beltran hit the winning home run against the pitcher who we wish had been on the mound for Game 7, I suppose, Jason Isringhausen. Speaking of games missed and grudges, I have to bring this up. I always bring this up. In 1986, I was 11, and Game 6 of the National League Championship Series between the Mets and Astros was on, I believe, a Wednesday. And my mom made me go to Hebrew school, and I was in Hebrew school with the Mets trailing 3-0. And the teacher says, you know what? It's time for a special project. And the other fifth grade class or sixth grade class comes into our room, and the other teacher has a radio with her. And we sat there and we listened to the ninth inning when the Mets scored 3 runs to tie the game, and they won in 16. And I got home in time to see the end. But I'm still mad at my mom for making me go.
Right.
But at least you saw the end.
So,
when you were talking about using RetroSheet to curate a lot of, like, you know, old box scores and things like that, I feel like I need to bring up what fans of this podcast, listeners of the podcast, may not know. Super fun fact about me: my genetics professor in undergrad is the inventor of RetroSheet. David Smith. Mm-hmm. I had him as a professor. He was my academic advisor as well, and he is basically the reason I'm a geneticist now. And I were super close. Like, he's probably one of the most influential mentors I've ever had in my academic career.
And he is a fantastic citizen as it comes to the baseball statistical community, too.
Yeah, like, meeting another person who is really into genetics and baseball stats, I was like, seriously? Like, you are my new best friend. I sat in his office for hours during my undergrad when we would just talk baseball for hours on end. It was great.
I have emailed him countless times, and this is before Baseball Reference got really developed, with questions where he would program his database of box scores and play-by-play for things like what I was doing for the Mets walk-off type thing. Like, hey, did this kind of walk-off ever happen before? The one that I always like to ask about is, was there ever a walk-off catcher's interference? Because that would be like the worst possible way to lose a game. And there was, and actually the catcher was Johnny Bench, which is crazy.
Wow.
So, and I have one other. So with the walk-offs, I think I wrote something like 50 essays about game 6 of the 86 World Series. Cause again, I was 11. It's like your moment right there. I was sitting 6 inches from the TV. Right, I'm sorry. I'm old. I'm the old person of the show. I was sitting 6 inches from the TV when the ball went through Buckner's legs. And that moment to me is like etched in my brain like nothing else. So I went to the Hall of Fame and asked for the Bill Buckner file. And there is some unbelievable stuff in the Bill Buckner file. But perhaps the most amazing, I'm using amazing specifically here, in his first major league game, he was on the Dodgers. It was 1969, and the Dodgers lost the game because a ground ball went through a player's legs in the bottom of the last inning.
Oh no!
True story, 100%.
Wow,
it's so cool.
Anyway, that's the kind of stuff that I look up,
and grateful that you do.
Yeah. Although I'm a little upset that Curtis Granderson isn't on your list, because I was at the game when he hit the home run to tie the game, and I think in the 10th inning, and then he hit the walk-off in the 11th. But, like, that was the first time that happened in Mets history, and I was there.
you should go check out the blog and look up number 52, because the Granderson versus Twins game is number 52 on the list.
Okay. All right, I'll accept that. I love Grandy. Grandy deserves that all.
I miss him.
I miss him so much.
Yeah, I miss him too. I miss him a lot. I miss him and Adam Jones just being a part of baseball. They are amazing citizens of the game. I miss them.
Yeah, just great ambassadors as a whole.
So before we move on to our kind of other mini segment on favorite Mets, Mark, I just wanted to shout out the tweets you've been doing on Giving Newsday. So if you want to tell our listeners a little bit about the organizations you've been shouting out on Twitter.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. So I think we're all a little frustrated during this time, and people get angry and people get irritated. And I tend to get irritated at certain things, political in nature, as I can imagine that many of you are. And I was like, what can I do to do something about that? And someone said to me, you have to like take your interests and try and just share them and try and just make people's days better. But also try to be if helpfulness is what you're looking for, try to be helpful. So I have sent out, I think it's now 15, 16 straight days, a tweet saluting a different reporting organization where I summarize what they do. Here's the link you can go to for more information. And these are places like Report for America, which is a program that gives opportunities to younger journalists to work covering really important things. Like there was a Report for America reporter at the Michigan State House when all those protests were going on who got hit in the head by a protester with a rifle. Wow. There's things like the World Federation of Science Journalists, the Society for Professional Journalists, a copy editors organization. I guess you could say I've run the gamut. And on Giving Tuesday, I listed a couple of others as well. You can check it out at Mark A. Simon Says. I've put up a good number of them, and it's a chance to educate yourself on the importance of a free and dedicated press as opposed to those who like to scream about things like fake news.
Yeah, it's an extremely noble cause, and I think we can all agree that good journalism is more important now than ever, and they need our support now more than ever, because a lot of journalism organizations are suffering because of the pandemic, in addition to, you know, many sectors. But it's really important during these times that we have accurate information. So,
yep.
Thanks, Mark.
Sure.
Hey, everyone, this is Kara Swisher, editor-at-large of Recode.
And I'm Scott Galloway, professor of NYU Stern School of Business.
We host the twice-weekly Pivot podcast, where we break down all the news in tech, media, and business, and anything else that we fancy we want to talk about.
The news is moving faster than ever, and we're here to bring some analysis, context, sanity, and occasional levity. Yeah, there's a lot of sanity around here. Anyways, to the COVID-19 news and economy. Kara?
All right, listen, Scott, listen. We don't want to bring levity to COVID-19. We think it's a very serious crisis. We want to give people insight and other ways to cope with COVID-19. We've had lots of ways to talk about it, whether it's through the economy, yeah, through relationships. And we talk about how tech is being used to track data and health and location, the privacy risks, yep, of living out our lives on platforms like Zoom, which can be a little dangerous, how streaming platforms like Netflix will excel or fail without sports broadcasting, and how this moment is changing the relationship between the labor force and major, yep, companies like Amazon. We cover the entire landscape of COVID-19.
We do. We also bring on great guests ranging from Robert Reich to Esther Perel to guide us through the economy and how COVID is changing our relationships.
How is our relationship changing, Scott?
Oh, I think you know it's getting stronger. I think you're finally in touch with your emotions. Let's be honest. I am the future ex Mrs. Swisher.
Yeah, great after Sean Hannity. Anyway, as Scott puts it, COVID-19 has been the great accelerator for companies, the economy, and public policy. Stay on top of it all by listening to Pivot with Kara Swisher and Scott Galloway every Tuesday and Friday. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts.
A magical island.
What can you see up there?
An ancient tree.
Find branches to climb up.
A spooky cave.
Is your island haunted by ghosts?
Where all the answers are.
Why?
Welcome to the island of Explained, where we answer kids' biggest questions about what's going on right now.
Why can't we go to schools and not do things that we have to be close?
Adult discretion is advised. But seriously, kids of all ages are welcome, even you grown-up kids. Come with us to the island on Spotify or wherever you listen to the Today Explained podcast.
Ah ha 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 ha. So in the second half of our show today, we are going to read the responses that we got. We tweeted out a little while back asking folks who their favorite med is and telling us their stories as to why. So we will read out the responses that we got on Twitter, but we'll start with all of us. So Mark, who is your favorite med and why?
All right. So when I was 8, I went to a baseball card show. And my dad used to make t-shirts. He owned a store where he could make t-shirts. And he made a t-shirt with Neil Allen's rookie card on it. Who was Neil Allen? Neil Allen was the closer of some very mediocre Met teams. But he was distinct because he had a huge leg kick, like where the leg would get up up near the bottom of his, like the leg would get up near his chin. And he had a really big curveball. And Neil Allen was in a slump in the early 80s, and he had some personal issues, too, that he was dealing with. But he did a baseball card show, and I brought my Neil Allen rookie card to get him to sign it, and he wasn't really, like, paying attention to people. And then he looks up, and he sees my shirt, and his face completely changed. And you could tell that his day was made better by that. And he's talking to me. I'm a little kid, and he's like, oh, I have to win games for you now. I have to pitch better. And the kicker to the story is that a couple of weeks later, he got traded for Keith Hernandez. But I decided I'm still being loyal.
For you.
So I am a loyalist to Neil Allen. I have, among other things, in my apartment, a watercolor painting that was painted by, if you guys are familiar with Joe Petruccio.
Yes,
he's amazing. I have a watercolor painting of that rookie card.
Oh, that's amazing.
I love that. So, Maggie, who's your favorite Met and why?
I've been thinking about this. And I didn't even really come into this recording with an answer. But I mean, I love David Wright. Like that, if I really had to like ride or die, that's the one. But, you know, I grew up when I was little, my favorite player was Daryl Strawberry because his name was also a food, and that's how old I was at the time. But
that's
I was
how
the
I
age...
liked him too.
Yeah, it's great. And what I didn't realize, you know, I would ask my mom every morning if Daryl Strawberry had hit a home run the night before, and the answer was frequently yes. But I didn't know at the time that was exceptional. Like I didn't know that he hit more home runs than anybody else. He was the one I wanted to hear about. So I love Daryl Strawberry. Daryl Strawberry was also the first time I learned to never have heroes because I read an article about him and his personal problems, particularly with women, when I was like maybe 16 or 17. And it definitely like broke me for a little bit. But on the other side of the spectrum of not having personal problems, we actually mentioned one of the other players who I just will always have a place for in my heart. And that's Curtis Granderson. You know, I always loved watching him play. His vibe is off the charts. He's just like a joyful person to watch, to hear from, you know, and then when he just came out in 2015 and he absolutely killed it in the World Series, was just perfect. I just love Grandy, everything about him. He's like a good person, and we just need more of those. So David Wright, but also Curtis Granderson.
Good answer. Linda,
yeah,
how about
great
you?
Great answer. See, I was like Maggie, and I've been going back and forth on this, and I've given it a lot of thought, and of course, David Wright, ride or die. Like, I think that's a given for everybody at this point. And then, of course, then there's Jake. And, of course, my man's JD now. And they're all fun. And I love them with all my heart. But they never would have existed if it wasn't for Robin Ventura. He's the one that got me into Mets baseball. And I love him and hate him for that. But, like, how I kind of looked at it is... Allison, I know this is probably going to hit home for you right now because you're watching them. Like, the Marvel movies started with Iron Man, and then it created this whole world after that. And so Ventura's kind of my Iron Man. Like, I might there might be better players. There might be, you know, like in the Marvel universe, there might be better movies. Like, obviously, Jacob deGrom is more accomplished than he is. David Wright's more accomplished than he is. But it all started with him. And I kind of can't get past that. Like, I who knows? Like, I wouldn't be writing for Amazing Avenue. I wouldn't be podcasting. So I have to, I just, and, you know, I love Piazza at the time, too. But it, I just, I, and also he spoiled me because I thought, you know, infield defenses were just good. And I just thought that's how it was. And now I realize that is not the case. So he kind of spoiled me back then. But so I have to, and then also that's the first time, you know, I saw my hero succeed on the big stage, too. So yeah, I have to go with Ventura. And as much as it breaks my heart to not say David Wright or Jacob deGrom, that has to be my final answer.
Yeah, that's awesome. I love him. Robin Ventura is very underrated in Mets lore, I think.
Yeah, absolutely.
Although I went to a game, it was the day after Matt Harvey's Near Perfect game, because I went to the next game because they were playing the White Sox. I was like, yes, he's coaching. I can go see him coach. So I wore my black Ventura jersey to the game, and I was so excited. And there was a family behind me on the escalator, and the father behind me, I hear him go, oh, a Ventura jersey. And the kids go, oh, who's that? So now I'm already upset because we can't even know. And then the father goes, oh, his first name was Ace as a joke. And the kids just accepted it. So not only did they not know who Robin Ventura was, they didn't know who Ace Ventura was either.
Damn kids not knowing their own history.
I was like, okay, I want to throw myself off this escalator now. Am I that old?
At some point, you just have to blame the parents.
You do. That was a total failure on that dad's part.
Yeah, for real.
Robin Ventura would have done very well in defensive run saves. He was as good as he gets at third base, for sure.
Yeah. Okay, that makes me very happy. I mean, I'm not surprised, but it's good to know the numbers back that up.
Yeah. For me, like, I don't know, with you guys, this is a really hard decision, and it's really hard to think of anyone to say other than David Wright, because for people of our generation, David Wright is the Mets, the way that Tom Seaver was the Mets for my dad's generation, and, you know, as far as, like, who, because I was already a Mets fan, like, a full throated Mets fan by the time David Wright came up. So as far as what players, because it's like there's categories of players like Robin Ventura for Linda that are the reason that you're a Mets fan. Then there's like the franchise players, and then there's kind of like your weird personal favorites. Yeah. So there's like three categories of favorite Mets. Obviously the like franchise Met category for me goes to David Wright. As far as like the players that made me a Mets fan, probably like a 50-50 split between Mike Piazza and Edgardo Alfonso. The 9/11 home run was hugely instrumental in my Mets fandom. Like, that is kind of like the moment I remember from those years. I'm a little bit younger than Linda, so I don't really remember those Mets like super well, like the 99-2000 team. I mean, I'm old enough that like I was around, and I remember, like, I was elementary school age, so, but I wasn't, like, all in on baseball yet. I was just kind of, like, you know, an observer of my dad being all in on baseball. Like, I don't remember too much of the 2000 World Series, thankfully, probably.
You're lucky, yeah. I know. Yeah, don't count your blessings.
Like, I remember my dad being very upset about it. and I remember, like, the like epicness of the Grand Slam single in 99 and all that, but like I don't consider those part of my personal Mets lore the way I consider the 9/11 home run to be like the catalyst of my Mets fandom. So for that reason, I think Mike Piazza is huge, and Edgardo Alfonso was like my favorite during that era, my personal favorite. So those two were hugely instrumental to my fandom, and obviously David Wright kind of just like cemented it. But an underrated pick for me, I think, for favorite Met, even though he's not underrated as a player, but like and it's hard because of everything that's gone down recently that has like tinged his legacy. But Carlos Beltran is so special to me as
such a good choice.
Because he was number 15, and 15 was always my favorite number. And so I already loved him because he wore my favorite number. And he was a hugely important player during that stretch of good Mets teams and during the 2006 playoff run. He had his best years with the Mets, really. And he was Hall of Fame. There's another defensive run saved guy. He did pretty damn good on defensive runs saved. Just the ultimate example of a five tool player. Does everything well. Every single facet of baseball, Carlos Beltran was great at it. And he's the reason why my soccer number was 15 my whole childhood and my whole adult life. Into my whole adult life, I wore 15 on my back, and it was all because of Carlos Beltran. So I think
it was because of Travis d'Arnaud.
No.
Okay, just checking.
Although I always do have like an extra little like love for whoever wears 15 at any given time, even if it's a nobody player. Not that Travis d'Arnaud's a nobody player, he was important, but like even if it's some rando bench guy, whoever wears 15 is like my favorite.
See, that's also me with Ventura. My lucky number is 4, so he was already in like right away. So, and I've been lucky, I had him and I had Wilmer, so 4's been pretty good. Four's for
been
me
pretty good. Yeah, and I had a Carlos Beltran jersey when I was a teenager, because Carlos Beltran played on the Mets kind of during my high school years. That was like the 06 Mets. And I had a Carlos Beltran jersey that I wore to soccer practice every single day because I was insistent that I was number 15 at all times, even when I was not uniform. So I wore my Carlos Beltran jersey to soccer practice every single day to the point where the coach started calling me Beltran, and that became my nickname. Like, people refer to me as Beltran, my soccer teammates. So I feel like because of that branding alone, Carlos Beltran has to be my pick.
Yeah, that's hard to argue with.
Yeah. I love Carlos Beltran, and this whole thing of him being manager and not has been emotionally devastating for me. So let's read some of our responses that we got on Twitter from various listeners and Amazing Avenue folks. So we'll start with Vaz, writer at Amazing Avenue. He said, I'll avoid the obvious, Piazza, Fonzie, and Wright, and go with Bobby J. Jones. Hell yeah, good pick. He was the first Met whose name I remembered, and when I started following the Mets. Even though he wasn't great or anything, I was a huge stan. I was so excited when he threw that one hitter in the 2000 NLDS. That is such a good, underrated pick.
And that game was amazing! He was so good that day. Against the Barry Bonds Giants!
Yep.
The funny thing is that Dusty Baker, if you ever bring that game up to him, he gets visibly upset.
Oh,
like he it really bothers him considerably that they I can tell you that when I asked him about Jones, he said he didn't. Well, I'll just say he didn't think that he was necessarily that good that day.
Oh, huh. So he's playing his team.
He just thinks that thinks that they got a little lucky. Yeah. And I will say this, he was locked in. Like that you were talking about how that's a favorite game. That guy was locked in from warm-up pitch number one. I remember watching the warm-ups of that game and being like, he's just, you know, get it and throw it, and locked in, and you saw it. That's an all-timer for me. That one is definitely a great one.
That's a very underrated series, too. Like, Benny Agbayani is the hero, Bobby Jones, like, it was just so random, and yeah, it's so perfect.
Yep.
So we've got Mets and the Memes on Twitter, the great Lord Buttermaker. Buttermarker. Buttermaker. Buttermaker. I really liked Carlos Gomez when he first came up. The thought of having two Jose Reyeses in the lineup made me salivate. I must have been 8 or 9 when they traded him for Santana. God, we're all old.
Oh, God.
Yeah, because if you were 8, oh, God. So naturally, I cried for an hour. Yeah, Carlos Gomez was going to be it, but it's nice that he got his Mets reunion. That's always good.
And he had a memorable day when he lost his shoe. Like,
that is going to go down in, like, in like remembering some guy's Mets lore for all time, for sure.
Yeah. And he also, you know, he was part of the trade that wasn't made. Like, he's in Mets history, whether he likes it or not.
Many times over.
He's a recurring character for the Mets. He is like...
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it.
Always around somewhere.
Recurring Mets characters, yes.
And, like, big moments, too. Like, he got a Santana, which led to the no-hitter. He was involved in the non-Cespedes. Like, we ended up getting Cespedes because of that whole thing. And Wilmer Flores crying. And, you know, they went on their run. And then coming back and losing a shoe in a big game against the Nationals.
Yee, yee, yee.
Yeah.
I was so hopeful he'd be good when he came back. I wanted it to be great, but maybe he'll be good. And
I was
like,
hoping, because he's fine. It would have been fine. And it wasn't meant to be.
It was not meant to be.
I've listened to this show a bunch of times, and I know that there have been some times where you've been watching a game and you jump in and you make a comment related to watching the game. I'm sorry, I just had to hold myself back because Aaron Altair hit a ball to the warning track in the Korean game that I'm watching.
Oh my God.
Oh no, you can shout it out. It's
really important update. Thank you.
It's Aaron Altair season.
It's a re-air of the one that was at 5:30 in the morning.
You weren't up? Nobody was up at that time?
Sorry. Yeah, this was at 1 o'clock in the morning, but no, it was not.
Yeah, it's Aaron Altair season on KBO.
I feel safe to say that Aaron Altair is nobody's favorite Met.
Probably not. No.
He got way too many at bats.
He comes first alphabetically.
Yes, that's true. He's number one alphabetically. He has that going for him.
It's true.
Number one alphabetically, number higher than that in our hearts.
The KBO games being broadcasted has been excellent for my brand because there are many, many former Mets and Orioles present, especially Orioles.
Yeah.
I just can't do it. I just got my sleep back. Yeah. I can't.
They rebroadcast them.
Yeah, it's true. I should be watching the rebroadcasts. I've been watching all the old Mets games on SNY.
And Gary Keith and Ron have been broadcasting a virtual game today, too.
Yeah, they watched they did one today, and then Jeff McNeil saw Sim. Jeff McNeil hit a home run, which was fun.
Yes. So we've got Dan Thornton replying with a very classic good answer, Keith Hernandez. My earliest memories were perennial losing teams in the late 70s and early 80s. Keith was the leader kicking off the 84 revival and leading to the 86 World Series win. So, yeah, I mean, absolutely. Even absent Keith's broadcasting career for the Mets, he's still... very much a symbol of the Mets' turnaround to becoming a great baseball team. And I think for that reason, he'll be forever. Even though, like, he really is a Cardinal as far as his, like, baseball legacy, but that's why he's such an important part of Mets history. It's not just, like, the amazing baseball he played for the Mets, which he played fantastic baseball for the Mets, but just, like, the symbolic meaning of, like, the turnaround putting the Mets back on the map, which I feel like is what Mike Piazza is he's like kind of that equivalent. Him and Gary Carter both are both symbolic of the Mets turning it around and becoming good again, and Mike Piazza was symbolic of the late 90s teams turning it around and becoming good again. So definitely a good answer.
And even though Keith, you know, played his best baseball for the Cardinals, and will never stop talking about how much he loves the Cardinals and everything about them. He did discover a real stardom. I mean, he was a star for the Cardinals for sure, but like the personality, the like pizzazz, you know, the real, literally being, you know, on television and that kind of thing. That was all so tied into his time in New York. Like, he would never have been Keith Hernandez the Cardinal on Seinfeld.
No, yeah,
exactly. On Seinfeld, on the Just for Men ads on TV,
on Sesame Street, the true King of Heroes.
Yes, and also, I don't know how people feel about this, but I think 17 should be retired.
I agree.
Yes, I would retire many more numbers than the Mets retire, and many fewer than the Yankees retire.
Yes, agreed. There's a happy medium there they need to find.
Yes. And I'm hoping that, you know, that they're kind of starting to get it. And I think that that they're going to start to retire a lot more numbers now.
They get money off of it because we all show up to the game.
Yeah.
Not rocket science.
Exactly.
So we've got, Linda, we've got another vote for Robin Ventura here from Mets Gal.
Yes.
Robin Ventura, that 1999 NLCS game was one of the last memories with my dad, and I'll cherish it forever. That is a damn good reason to have Robin Ventura as your favorite. Dennis has a podcast, tells us, Seth Lugo, I'm not sure you need me to extrapolate. Hell yeah, Dennis. I'm with you, buddy.
Seth Lugo.
Seth Lugo's my man.
We don't need Dennis to extrapolate, but we sure love it when he does.
Yeah.
Seth Lugo rules. So we've got Lev Gersel saying Sean Green. That is an off the wall answer. I love
Hold on. It's Sean Green. S-E-A-N or S-H-A-W-N?
S-H-A-W-N.
S-H-A-W-N. Okay. My grandpa told me stories of how awesome it was watching Koufax pitch for the Dodgers, so I thought it would be cool when another really good Jewish ball player was on my favorite team.
Aww.
Well, he tried.
He did. And then we've got Greg Patenaude. Three acquisitions in Mets history that are standouts above all others. Staub, Hernandez, and Piazza. Carter is an honorable mention. Yeah, that's kind of like what we were talking about before.
Yeah.
Like, acquisitions that really put the Mets on the map. And honestly, like, I'll put Carlos Beltran up there with those others. Because I think for the 06 team, that's Beltran. The Mets made...
And that was Cespedes, too.
Yeah, and it's Cespedes. It's kind of like there's always, like, the one or two guys that were their big star acquisitions that made you feel like, okay, yeah, the Mets are back. They're serious about winning. And Beltran was that for the 06 team, I think.
It's so nice when a thing goes right, because so often it goes so horribly, horribly wrong.
Yeah, I know, right? Those are some really good answers. And I like the variety, too. I do like that people didn't just go for the easy answers, even though obviously, like, David Wright is the obvious answer for many people of our generation. But I like that people picked a variety of Mets.
Well, sometimes sometimes there's no rational reason to why you just happen to like a dude.
Yep.
Or like a dude, because that definitely comes up.
Oh, yes, it does.
Can I tell you that it is extraordinarily rare that I run into someone, but I have run into at least one other person who said that Neil Allen was their favorite Met. So, it's amazing how you, like, every player has their people. I guess that's kind of the cool thing about baseball.
Well, my sister always liked the funky, like, side armors, so she really liked Jason Isringhausen for a while.
Chad Bradford.
I liked Kirk Nieuwenhuis for a while because I remembered how to spell his name.
Yes.
That's quite an accomplishment, actually.
It is.
You just have to say it in your head kind of phonetically, like Neo and Huis.
No.
Okay.
It was always, those were the two for me that were always the most difficult were Nieuwenhuis and Doug Mankiewicz.
Yeah.
Oh, I still can't get Mankiewicz.
Doug Mankiewicz.
M-I-E-N-T-K-I-E-W-I-C-Z?
I think that's right.
Sure. We're not going to say no.
Not going to say you're wrong, because I can't prove you wrong.
I was just watching a documentary on the 2000 Olympic baseball team, and Mankiewicz was on fire during that series. He hit like a walk-off home run. I think he hit two walk-off home runs. I was like, wow, yeah. I do not remember this.
Remembering some guys.
Yeah, and Ben Sheets pitched a complete game shutout against the Cubans to win the gold medal in 2000.
Wait, did Doug Mankiewicz wear 15 on the Mets? It might have worn 16, because I was like, I liked him, and it might have been because it was 15, but I think he was 16. Doug Mankiewicz, Mets. I'm Googling this live on the pod. It's scintillating.
Did you spell his name right?
It auto-filled it for me, so yes. Oh, he was 16. Okay, that's why.
Yeah, I thought so. I think he was a good mentor to David Wright, though, so he did serve his purposes.
Speaking of, like, David Wright, my favorite, probably my most favorite, like truly random dude is probably Ty Wigginton.
Yes, I love him.
I freaking love Ty Wigginton. And I remember, like, and I think I might have mentioned this on the pod before, but ignorant as I was as a youth, I, when David Wright was coming up, that meant Ty Wigginton's tenure as the Mets third baseman was coming to an end. And I remember when they were cleaning out his locker, I cried.
I was mad that they called David Wright up because I like Ty Wigginton.
I know. I was like, this David Wright guy displacing Ty Wigginton.
It's my guy. How dare you?
Yeah. How naive I was.
I know. I remember being so mad. I'm sorry, David. We didn't know. It was a different time.
We were children. No. So... Yes, those are our favorite Mets. If you still have, if you want to tell us who your favorite Met is and you didn't get a chance to tell us before the show, feel free to tweet at us who your favorite Met is and why. And extra points if you have a really quirky answer and story to go along with it. We like those.
Yeah, that's awesome.
But we will finish off the show this week like we do every week with walk-off wins, where each of us talks about what is making us happy this week, baseball related or otherwise. Mark Simon, what is your walk-off win?
All right. I think I have something that will satisfy the audience here. I have, during the time of the pandemic, looked for a lot of different entertainment kind of things. And one that I came across that I like, it's kind of nostalgic, is on Instagram. It's called Save With Stories. And what it is it's celebrities reading children's stories.
Yes, I have seen that.
Yep. Sometimes they're reading them to kids that are there. Sometimes they're just reading them to people that are just essentially to you. And they're good because it's kind of like a flashback to childhood. There's like, I saw Bedtime for Francis, Caps for Sale, Frog and Toad, books that I read when I was a little kid. And it's for charity. It's for two different organizations, Save the Children and No Kid Hungry. They help provide food and resources to children during the time of the pandemic. And here's the punchline. Two Mets have contributed to Save With Stories. One of them is Mr. Met. The other reading Good Night, Good Night, Moonlight Train is Curtis Granderson.
Oh, she reads a book about a train? You don't understand what this will mean to my family.
Yes, I have
a rail fan.
Yes.
And this is going to be epic. Thank you. I'm very excited about this. This makes my night.
And there are a lot of other people that just as a going back to the thing about journalists. Sophia Bush did a really good one. That's a children's story, but I think the adults will appreciate it because you can relate it to immigration and getting the opportunity to meet new people of different cultures and backgrounds. And her story in particular that she shared was one of the ones that I really liked.
That's awesome.
That is really good. And I have to check out more of that. I've only seen a couple, but from all of that I've seen, they've been really good so far.
Yeah, yep. Linda, this pushes your librarian buttons quite well.
It does, but they're putting me out of business, too. Like, I can't compete with that. Yeah, I can't compete with Curtis Granderson.
Come on, guys. The libraries need their virtual story times, too.
Exactly.
Linda, what is your walk-off win for this week?
I had one. Okay. Well, first, my cousin successfully defended his dissertation, I think, yesterday. So he's very, very smart and a lot smarter than me. And so it was kind of like weird because, you know, it was all virtual and it was a Zoom. And so we all got the invite. And so I'm sure he was super nervous to not only have to defend his dissertation, but then to have his entire family sitting there too. Like, no pressure, sure. My aunt texted shortly after saying, that it was accepted, so he's doctor now. So congratulations to Phil, and you know, I knew he was gonna be fine. Like, he shouldn't have been nervous if he was. But so yeah, so he did his dissertation on HIV and how it's smart enough to go around your, like, any defenses your body has, it somehow finds a way to go around it. So I just, like, it blows my mind that you can study, like, these microscopic things. Like, I don't know how you do that, Allison. Like, it just, it's like, it, that you can see these things. And that, you know, you just can't see with the naked eye. Like, it's just incredible to me. So I have a great appreciation of what you do, what he does. So that's the first thing. And then, like, I want to say an hour before we started podcasting, my friend texted me a picture of a sonogram. So she's expecting her first baby.
Oh, yay!
Yeah, so she's expecting her first baby in November, and she's healthy. She's the one whose wedding I went to in Toronto back in December.
Oh, right.
So, yeah. So, congratulations to her. She's feeling good. I mean, it's not ideal having to do telemedicine right now. But she's, I guess she said everything looks good. She's good. The baby's good so far. So, congratulations to her and her husband and the whole family.
That's awesome.
That's great.
As a newly minted, relatively newly minted PhD myself, I have a great deal of sympathy for all of the graduate students that are trying to defend their theses right now.
I can't imagine.
All I've been thinking about lately is, like, how lucky I feel to not still be in grad school right now, because it's so stressful. Like, if I couldn't go to the lab and do my work, my graduation would have been delayed by months, probably years by this. And, like, defending my dissertation, like, even though it was nerve-wracking to give the big talk in front of all the people, but, like, it was the culmination of 6 years of work, and, like, getting to celebrate that in person with my friends, my family, my graduate advisors, all my student friends, all my fellow graduate student friends, my cohort, like, everybody was, you know, really, like, satisfying and, you know, heartwarming to celebrate that with all the people I care about. And so to not really be able to do that and only have that be virtual, this huge, like, part of your life, like, I sympathize a great deal with that. I'm sad for them. It sucks. I mean, my roommate from Baltimore, who was in my same program, she's going through that now because she hadn't graduated yet. Luckily, her work hasn't been impacted because she was in the final stages kind of already and, like, planning to defend. So all she's really doing is writing, which she can do from home, writing her thesis. But, like, she's going to have a virtual thesis seminar, and that sucks. Like, I would have loved to have gone down to Baltimore to see her graduate, but I can't. So it sucks a lot. It sucks a lot. Maggie, what is your walk-off win for this week?
So this is a little outdated because I found out about it when it had already been running for a week. But so as a little bit of background, I love ballet. I did ballet for many years as a child. And for as long as I can remember, my mom and I have had a tradition of we go to the ballet every year, usually, I mean, always for my birthday and then often for Christmas as well. We always go to New York City Ballet. And for the period, for like the next month or so, New York City Ballet is putting a ballet up for streaming twice a week. And this is a huge deal because New York City Ballet has always been super, super stingy with anything more than the most cursory clip that they will put online. So it's amazing because we can watch the ballet and I can watch, you know, not with my mom, but, you know, simultaneous with my mom. And that's, you know, my mom, she was really sick. She had COVID-19, like, back at the very kind of beginning of all this. And, like, you know, this is one of those things where, you know, when your mom's on a ventilator, you think about a lot of different things. And certainly I thought a lot about ballet and getting to see that with her again. And so it's really nice to be able to have access to that right now. And I hope they extend it because they have this amazing library of ballets from the last decade or so. Absolutely incredible stuff. And it's just never online. So, yes. Yeah, so check it out. we'll link to all this kind of stuff, but it's on YouTube. It's on their YouTube channel. And yeah, they're wonderful. So every Tuesday and Friday, a new one drops, and it's only up for 3 days. So
yeah, that's really good. I didn't realize that. And it's a good way to introduce people to ballet too.
Yeah. And they, New York City Ballet has some really approachable stuff. Not necessarily just like the kind of silly things like the Nutcracker, but like real serious ballets, but that don't feel kind of crusty and outdated, that feel like something fresh and meaningful.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And we'll try. Like Maggie said, we'll link to that in the tweets and show notes and such like that, so you guys can access it if you so choose. My walk-off win this week it has to do with the support network of friends and family I have and how grateful I am for them. I've been going through a lot this week, and I'm not going to go into details about it because I'm not going to bore you all with it, but basically, like, trying to make huge life choices and trying to find a job and coordinate a career with your significant other while they're trying to start their career and you're trying to find a place to live during this whole pandemic situation is not great. I don't recommend it. And so
that's one of those things that's
hard.
Not a pandemic.
Yeah, it's stressful during normal times, and now the stress is just like multiplied by a lot, a huge factor. And so, you know, like the people closest to us know that we're going through these changes, trying to find jobs, and so I was with Michael this weekend, and we were about to go on a walk, and the we just like opened the door and there's a package for him at the front step, and I was like, did you order anything like on Amazon or anything? He was like, no. And he opens it and it's a crumb cake that his sister just like delivered to him because she was like, you're job hunting, this sucks, and also like congratulations on the offers you've gotten so far and trying to make a choice, here's a crumb cake. So we like got the surprise delivery of the crumb cake, and we're like, oh, that's very sweet. And then we like go about our day, and we're like making dinner, and he gets a phone call, and it's a pizza delivery guy is delivering us a pizza, and we're like, we didn't order a pizza. And it turns out my best college friends, three of them are our roommates, so they all live together. The three of them ordered a pizza to Michael's apartment for us because they knew we were stressed out. And so they were like, here's a pizza. Aww. And I was like, wow, you guys are so nice. This just made my entire day. So we were like in the middle of making dinner, and I was like, now we can eat this tomorrow and eat pizza now. And so it was just really sweet to like get two surprise deliveries from family and friends in one day. So that's my walk-off win for this week. It's just, I'm very grateful, even though we're going through a stressful time right now. I'm really grateful that I know I have people in my life to support me no matter what happens. So it makes me happy. So that does it for the show this week. Mark Simon, where can folks find you on the interwebs?
Number of places. Twitter, Mark A. Simon Says. A is my middle initial. That's when Mark Simon Says was taken. And also sportsinfo_SIS. We have a podcast of our own called the Sports Info Solutions Baseball Podcast that you can learn more about some of the things that we talked about today.
And you should also be reading Mark's work on The Athletic as well. So, yeah, follow Mark on Twitter, read his work on The Athletic, listen to the podcast. We highly recommend it. In the meantime, you can also go to AmazingAvenue.com and get all of our fantastic Mets content. Chris McShane is continuing to play around with the virtual Mets, so we will continue to provide updates on them. Among other things, you can follow the show on Twitter at A Pod of Their Own. You can please subscribe to the show on all the things, Spotify, Stitcher, iTunes, wherever you get your podcasts from. Subscribe to the show, rate and review the show. It really helps. Follow the show on Twitter. You can follow each of us on Twitter. I am at Petite PhD. Where are you, Linda?
At Linda Servage.
And you, Maggie?
At Maggie162.
The original intro and outro music to this podcast is by Bunga. Let's go Mets. And don't forget, there is no crying in podcasting.
Are you troubled by strange hockey trades in the middle of the night?
Do you experience feelings of dread about NHL free agency?
Have you or your family ever seen a New York Islanders game?
If the answer is yes, then don't wait another minute. Pick up your mobile device and subscribe to Lighthouse Hockey Podcast from SB Nation today.
Our courteous and efficient hosts are ready to serve all of your Islander needs and worries.
Lighthouse Hockey Podcasts for New York Islanders fans.